pavement. There they dropped her, and for good measure shoved her back against the wall with a few well-placed boots. Boots that left bloody prints as they walked away. The dark receded, the tunnel walls now a glossy larva white. Black ribs rose to the ceiling, connecting to spines of gray piping. Rings of light hung from that constructed backbone, flashing overhead at precise intervals as if trying to calm Gus's grief-stricken mind. Kali crouching, then her back exploding in a black flare. That sight was going to haunt him for a long time, a very long time. The desire to be done with it all filled him, and he wanted nothing more than to curl up on the bottom of the EV's floor and hope that Corey drove it over a cliff. He couldn't go on. Not now. Not without her. She was the direction he needed, the driving force he very much depended on, and the lady that gradually over time had captured his heart, as cliche as it sounded. The ceiling lights flared overhead like calming sunspots. Then they slowed. Gus covered his eyes. He didn't care. Didn't care when Whitecap's spinal cord of lights and pipework disappeared into a stainless steel maw crenellated with blunted tusks. The EV braked hard and the world shifted, rolling him into the rear of the driver's seat, where he saw the brass gleam of a lost loony on the carpeted floor, right below the cushioned springs. "Where's Collie?" Bruno asked, distracting Gus. "She's gone," Corey answered, the EV bouncing as he got out of the vehicle.
"Gone?"
"Yeah." Silence then, but someone said shit in a stunned tone.
"What's the plan?" one of them asked. "Maybe the one called Jeremy Walton."
"Level 5," Sarah Burton said with a dazed sigh. "She said get to level 5, so that's where we go."
More silence, followed by hands grabbing Gus and lugging him out of the rear seat. He stood in a drunken stupor, not resisting.
"Oh, man, he stinks," Jane Wong said.
"Yeah, well, life stinks," Gus thought blackly. Life was just a black-crusted shithole, and he was a dingleberry hanging off it. All he wanted now was to be done with it.
"All right, we go," Sarah Burton said. "Gus, we're leaving."
Leaving. He didn't take his eyes off his stained boots. Leaving sounded just fine to him.
"Maybe I'll leave too," he said, and looked up for the first time.
The lighting system wasn't completely on, and more than 3/4 of them were dark, powerless plates. The ones that were on, however, produced cones of pallid light. The Islanders were in a hangar. No, a garage of massive proportions, where reflective white lines split apart into parking zones. Cars and trucks filled some of those spaces, gleaming underneath that sparse light. Way off near the back, where the light barely touched, were what might have been a pair of backhoes. Extensive pipework and clusters of huge panel boxes adorned the walls. Some of these boxes were fire stations. A set of enormous doors, perhaps steel or titanium, marked the entrance. Their edges were lined with rectangular blocks designed to interlock in a precise seam when closed. Beyond the doors was the tunnel they had just traveled through. The lights began to wink out at the moment, right up to the doors, creating a void in its wake.
"Hey!"
Gus turned around. Bruno was there, Pirate Cap Bruno, looking more scared than pissed off, but putting on a face, because little Monica was standing not a foot behind him, red-eyed and jittery, as if she were just coming to her senses after a serious fright. That sight brought Gus back to his senses, and he faced Bruno.
"Yeah.
You okay?"
"No, not really."
"You know how to get to level 5?
"Not really, no."
That quieted everyone.
"Well, that's just great," Jeremy Walton muttered. "Level 5 is around here somewhere," Sarah Burton snapped. "We get to a staircase and figure it out from there."
Gus's attention drifted to what looked like a space-age chamber against the far-right wall. It was the length of 2 school buses with a single glass window that stretched at least half that. All manner of chairs and consoles filled the area inside, and Gus spied something that lifted his spirits. A gun rack, partially filled, with accompanying lockers.
"Did you figure out the doors?" Corey asked, nodding at the impressive entrance.
No, Sarah reported. It needed a security code. I punched in a few keys, but no. Those doors are staying open, which means we gotta get moving, now.
They'll be here soon, Corey said.
How many, Gus? Bruno asked.
Gus focused on him again.
What?
How many are there?
A lot, Gus replied in a lifeless tone. All of them. The tunnel was filled, lips and assholes. We.
His throat clutched at the thought of Kali again. He cleared his pipes.
We slowed them down, shot a few even, but there's more. Plenty more.
That silenced them.
The cars work, Sarah Burton offered, indicating a bank of parked battery-charged vehicles.
There were more than enough to transport the group.
We take those and get going. Right now.
After a flurry of assenting nods and grunts, the group turned to leave. Bruno and Corey had gone 5 steps when Monica stopped them, pulling on Bruno's sleeve. She pointed. Gus remained standing next to the EV he rode in on.
Hey, Bruno said. You thinking of making a last stand or something?
Sorta.
Well, forget it, he said with a disapproving scowl.
Come on, man. She'd kick your...
He glanced at Monica, wavered, then said,
Kali would kick your ass if you tried that shit.
Yeah, she would, Gus agreed. Guaranteed. Which is why I'm not doing that. But I'm not coming with you guys either.
That stopped the rest of the pack. As an answer, Gus reached up and squeezed his beard, wringing it free of the rotten liquid. Droplets speckled the floor.
You all smell it, he said. I took one of those piss bags right across the chops. I'm spattered with the shit. And you know what that means. They still got some moes left. I don't know how many, but I know if I go with you, they'll track us down. They'll track you down. So, I'm staying here.
He rolled his eyes, indicating the garage.
Somewhere around here anyway. Whichever way you go, I'll go in the other direction. Give you more time.
Hell with that, Corey said. Just strip right here.
It's not only on my clothes, it's on me, Gus explained. My face, my beard, I'm covered. Look, you go on now. Don't worry about me. I'll find you when I'm able.
You too, he nodded at Bruno and Corey. Take them back to the island. I'll get back eventually. No more than a couple of weeks.
If you can, their expressions said. Bruno stared, torn between arguing the point, or staying, or some other shit Gus couldn't understand. A second later, however, the man extended his hand.
No handshakes, Gus said, warding off the gesture. I got this shit on my hands. I don't think the mindless need much to find you.
Bruno dropped his arm.
If you, stick around here.
Any amount of time,
he began in a creaky voice.
And come across any nudie books.
Gus smiled.
You got it. You bet.
That seemed to satisfy him. Bruno turned and faced the others.
All right, we're wasting the man's time.
The islanders moved. Sarah Burton nodded at Gus before hauling herself aboard an EV. Corey was already behind the wheel.
Watch yourself, Gus, he said. Good luck.
They finished piling into the 2 vehicles and started the rigs. Rich Trinidad hung back, sizing up Gus as he in turn sized up the gunslinger.
Want one of these? Rich asked.
He held up a very futuristic gun in one hand. It was sleek, black, and shorter than most rifles. The sight of the weapon got Gus's attention.
Yeah, he said. I do.
Over there, in that long-ass booth there. We didn't take them all. We were going to, but we decided to wait. Until you got back.
Gus glanced at the booth along the far wall.
Thanks, he said. I'll do that.
Don't take all day now.
I won't.
Rich Trinidad considered the EV and people waiting for him. He backed up and boarded the vehicle. His cowhide vest gleamed underneath the sparse light, and he tipped his sombrero in Gus's direction. Jane Wong sped off first,
Corey followed, while his passengers Bruno, Monica, and Rich Trinidad kept their eyes on Gus. Jane Wong signaled right.
"We're going down," Sarah Burton shouted, her voice carrying in the garage.
"Shit," Gus cringed, glancing over his shoulder to see if anyone was coming up the tunnel. When he looked back, Sarah and Jane were already gone, and Corey was about to make his turn.
Monica waved.
Gus lifted his hand, but the little girl disappeared around the turn before he could wave back.
36. The EVs were completely silent as they whizzed around the corner, out of Gus's sight. He stood there in that overwhelming garage and hung his head. Oddly enough, no thoughts went through his mind, not a goddamn one. He was drawing a blank, and in his grief, the idea pushed through that perhaps he should start thinking. Start remembering.
"You thinking of making a last stand?" Bruno asked him.
"Sorta."
"Well, forget that shit. Collie would kick your ass if you tried that shit."
He chuckled. Collie would indeed kick his ass if he tried that shit. But damn, he was tempted. So very, very tempted. And even though ultimately he hadn't really decided which way he was going to go, he was going to do one thing before all else. He released a long sigh.
"Just so you know,"
he whispered into that haunting silence of the garage,
"I think about you. A lot. A whole lot."
And then he was back. Back at Lazy Lou's showroom, on that wonderful piece of mattress heaven, face to face with Collie. His words quieted her, and she frowned ever so slightly in the dark.
"A lot," she asked him.
"Yeah."
"Well, that's good. I think about you, too. A lot."
And Gus believed, truly believed, that his happiness at that moment in time rivaled the brightness of the sun.
"Yeah," he whispered again.
He looked towards the yawning chasm of darkness that was the tunnel.
"Yeah," he said with a little more heat, a little more resolve.
"Well, that's good," Collie agreed. "I think about you too, a lot. Still got a chubby?"
Gus barked a laugh and wiped the side of his miserable, ass-stinking face. He shook his head and stared at the dark tunnel, Whitecap's throat. And he was standing, he supposed, not quite around the back teeth area, but close enough. The gun rack caught his eye then. From where he stood, he could see three of them, three of those high-powered, death-dealing bang sticks.
"Got half a chub, babe," he said as he walked over to the open door of the booth. "At least half a chub."
The booth was indeed some sort of checkpoint, streamlined and clean enough that it might have been quarantined. All the interior lights were switched on, which made him wonder why the room was still powered, but not the rest of the place.
Government bunker, he figured.
Probably had a janitorial equivalent of an AI or the sort programmed to go into sleep mode, or limited sleep mode. There was a keypad to the right of the door, but he left it untouched. All he needed to do was punch in a number or two and have the door slam shut in his face. Gus stepped into the room, perhaps just a little wider than a bus. He went over to the gun rack and softly whistled at the sophistication of the firearms. "Belgium made" was stamped into the stock, along with the serial number, ST1X9990T.
"Sticks," Gus whispered.
"Boom, sticks," he added as a smile spread across his face.
"That's a goddamn good omen if I ever saw one."
He took one of the weapons, marveling at how light it was. The gun was awkward against his shoulder at first, as the barrel and stock were much shorter than he was used to. Once he braced it, however, he understood how it was supposed to fit his shoulder and his hand. Along the top of the weapon, a clear plastic casing contained what appeared to be a fucking leg's worth of stacked ammunition.
"Jesus,"
Gus whispered. He started counting the rounds and gave up after he got to 40, telling himself he had a shit ton of ammunition. If and when he ran out, the gun would let him know. Beneath the rack was an open cupboard. 5 more identical magazines lay upon the top shelf, leftover ammunition the Islanders had left for him and Kali. They were just over a foot long, and he realized the ammunition itself probably weighed more than the actual gun. He placed the spare mags on a desk.
All right, he huffed. Armed and fucking dangerous.
And so very alone. Gus stewed in that depressing moment, but not for long. His fucked up foot distracted him, buzzing like an outboard motor stuck in neutral.
Enough of that shit, he rumbled as he hefted the weapon.
He peered through its sights, noting the blue targeting dot in the center. Open lockers stood against the wall just past the computers, in the back where there weren't any windows looking into the garage. A light switched on as he stepped in front of one locker, illuminating the contents of the cubbyhole. Combat gear. Gus scowled at the padded vests, knee pads, elbow pads, and riot shields. He tapped the Styx's muzzle on one shield. Not glass, not plastic either, but some other material he was unfamiliar with. There were metal shields as well, but after lifting each one, he let them be, deeming them too heavy. He'd need both hands for the Styx. His eyes drifted back to the body armor. It wasn't turnout gear from a fire station, and thus didn't offer full body protection, but it would work for now. He struggled into the armor, thanking Christ above for Velcro straps and plastic buckles. The chest piece was bulky, ribbed, with an excess of flaps and pockets. The armor was light, however, which he greatly appreciated, and once he had it on, he paused and glanced around the place for a mirror, of which there was not one. Gus pulled on the elbow and knee pads. He left the boots, but grabbed a helmet and pulled out a black balaclava stuffed inside. The wool mask went on, as did the helmet, in a comfortably snug fit. A black visor protected his eyes, while an extensive bar shielded his cheeks and jaw. Feeling positively badass, Gus paused when he realized he could smell his own foul breath, as well as the nut juice in his beard. Fuck me, he muttered, taking in that stink. He reached up under the face bar and pinched both the chin strap and the balaclava to get some fresh air in there. He looked around for gloves, but failed to locate any. There was some tactical webbing, but he was at a loss as to how to put it on.
That's that, he grumbled.
He stepped over to the spare magazines, picked up one, and realized he had nowhere to put the damn thing.
Don't laugh, Kali, he whispered. I'm doing what I can. You should see me with paint gear.
On impulse, he leaned over the desk and peered out the window, eyeing that yawning black chasm that was the outer tunnel. Nothing came forth. It was blissfully quiet. He examined one of the computer terminals, one of which was already powered up. It showed a red screen curtly asking for an authorization code. Gus left it and walked back out into the garage. He spotted a black luxury liner of a limousine parked in front of a bank of elevator doors at the far wall. He had to walk a few steps to really get a good look at the car, but there was no mistaking it. The thought of what the hell was a limo doing in a secret government bunker didn't last for long. No doubt it belonged to the Prime Minister. The EV Corey had picked him and Kali up in was nearby, and still functional. A quick inspection of the basic controls and Gus figured he could drive the thing. He returned to the main booth and leaned against the corner in thought. He settled in and gazed at the dark tunnel beyond. It was almost peaceful, except for the shitty smell all around him. With a sigh, he cradled the Styx in one arm, pointing it at the ceiling. They would be coming sooner or later. He'd be waiting for them when they did. 37. Gus jerked into focus when an explosion rolled along the length of the tunnel's throat, followed by a haunting metallic peal of failing steel. There was a second deep-throated groan of what might have been a submarine's hull being squeezed to a breaking point, then a startling clap of an immense collapsing weight, not unlike a beer can being crushed next to a microphone. Then silence. Gus scanned the tunnel, his automatic weapon, at least he thought it was automatic, ready and braced against his shoulder. His anxiety level had gone from 0 to 10 in an instant. Nothing moved within the dark, but he knew they were out there. Getting closer.
He waited, still positioned at the booth's corner, wavering on whether he should stay and make like he was brave or run for higher ground. The plan was to buy enough time for Bruno, Corey, Monica, and the rest of them to get away, to find that secret door and get out of Whitecap. But what if they couldn't? What if the exit wouldn't open for them? He vaguely remembered Collie once talking about being unable to enter the bunker from the outside because those access points were secured and locked from the inside. But what if whatever had initially blasted the ceiling out and blocked the main tunnel had also rendered that escape route useless?
There's a way out, he whispered, trying to alleviate those thoughts. Right, Collie? That's right. Why else would you send them to level 5? They can get out. Sure they can. I just hope they can find it.
With an uneasy swallow, he leaned against the corner and kneeled. He wished for infrared goggles or some other fancy soldier shit to help him see in the dark. He bet there was something like that in the complex behind him, which was weird, as you would think they'd have it near the entrance. That lack of foresight annoyed him. At least he had a gun with ammunition. Considerable ammunition. All he needed now were targets. If things got hairy, he had two options: retreat into the guard booth, or jump into the EV and drive for the coast. Figuratively speaking, of course. A minute passed. Then two. Nothing moved in the tunnel. Ammunition, he thought while eyeing the dark. He faltered and checked his weapon. He'd already flicked off the safety, so that wasn't bothering him, but he sensed something amiss. Plenty of ammunition was inside the booth, and he could quickly reload if he... Gus stopped and studied the weapon in the frail overhead light. A chill lanced through him. How the hell did you reload the goddamn thing? Did the magazine pop out or eject straight up or what? Shit, he whispered, not seeing any kind of switch that did just that. Well, shit. Then he heard it. A low wail, like a gush of water from a broken dam, except it was a rabid flood of voices rising and falling. A harsh, tuneless screaming that weakened his knees the very second he identified it. Gus should have been used to that sound by now. The truth was, however, he'd usually been drunk, imperviously drunk, and rendered 100% mentally bulletproof against the horrors of the day. He had no such protection this time. With the maddening roar now filtering out of the tunnel and into the garage, Gus rose and went back inside the security booth. He took the two other Styx battle rifles off the rack and carried all three back to the corner. Once there, he leaned the extra weapons against the wall within easy reach. They were all loaded, and he figured it would be easier to grab a fresh firearm than reload a spent one. That was his thinking, anyway. And God above, how the mindless screamed. A sing-along of enraged gibberish, tormented and plague-ridden, and yet absolutely yearning to either spread their disease or just straight up kill. And not just kill, but tear the living apart. Gus listened to the approaching squall of insanity. For a full minute, he vacillated between shooting them all or running away. There were a lot of mindless charging toward him, a regular rampaging mob of thrashers. Sweat dribbled into Gus's eye and he squinted it away. The stink still plaguing him was borderline stomach-turning rancid. His bad foot was livid, droning on like two bees fucking in a thin blanket. His fingers flexed upon the gun's grip under the barrel. Nothing appeared out of the dark. Even more interesting, the motion automated lights remained off, the same lights that he and Corey had triggered when they drove through the tunnel. His ears perked as he caught a new sound, one that accompanied the mindless screaming. An underlying beat to the screeching, flaming disintegration of vocal cords, as if an entire town was attempting to gargle through one massive, coordinated act of fire-eating. Gus didn't know what that new sound was, but it came across like barrels rolling across a floor. Then it hit him. Boots. That straightened his spine. Hundreds of boots, sneakers, bare feet, whatever the fuck. And all of them running toward him, smelling him, knowing he was just ahead at the end of a long and tenebrous passageway. Collie, Gus whispered, scanning that impenetrable screen of tar just beyond the box, feeling his throat click as he swallowed. Listen, this might have been a bad idea. He glanced back at the EV, its headlights pointed towards the deeper parts of the garage.
Shit.
He should have scouted out the rest of the garage, made certain he knew where he was going and what he was doing, but he didn't. At the time, he was ready to die, ready to go down underneath a mass of twisting, writhing limbs and biting mouths, firing or swinging or just plain swearing all the while. With every passing second, he realized just how wrong he was. Again, he glanced at the EV. 10 steps and he'd be there. 10 seconds and he'd be driving off, picking up speed and trying to outdistance what was coming. The nagging intensity of his foot was cut off by the energy thrumming in his calves. A spike in volume yanked his attention back to the tunnel mouth. Gus stared into that sunless space beyond the bunker. His chest ached. He braced his rifle hard enough against his shoulder to make it hurt. He waited for the storm. And waited. And waited. And then, as though a curtain had suddenly lifted, the automated tunnel lights blinked on and there they were. A monstrous collage of faces, hundreds strong, popping into sight in near-perfect unison. A fire hydrant gush of torsos, chugging arms, and sprinting legs that all seemed to shift into an even higher gear of frenetic energy upon the horde smelling him. That livid, emaciated line of insanity charged forward, hundreds of eyes bright with rage and jaws stretched wide, and they thundered towards the subterranean end zone that was the wide-open bunker. The screaming had long since peaked, yet feral shrieks of pure, wicked glee punched through the unvarying roar, spiking the air. Against instinct, against every fiber of his worn-out body urging, begging him to haul ass out of there, Gus stepped out from the corner and fired. 38. A murderous spray of gunfire cut across the charging zombies. Chests erupted, heads blasted apart, chunks blew out of necks, shoulders shredded in a blink before the line of starfire whipped across faces and violently removed them. The air became a carbonated mist of blood as the first rank collapsed, instantly tripping up the second and third ranks. A huge wedge formed in the middle of that tsunami of savagery then, as if God himself took a whack at it with the back of a shovel. The wings of the mob, however, sped onward, homing in on their target. So Gus alternated left and right and hosed them down as well. The sticks had no recoil, no kick. Tracer fire erupted from the muzzle in an unending Morse code of death. Spent casings shat straight down Gus's left leg in a heavy patter, rather than to the side like some of the other guns he'd fired. Of course, this was the first time he'd gotten his hands on an automatic weapon. A military-grade automatic weapon. And like a firefighter wielding a high-pressure hose, he whipped that thunder stick to the right, wiping out a dozen or so figures with it in mere seconds. Then he raked it across the floundering middle, then toward the left wing. Gus was smiling. Hunched over with his cheek plastered against the gun, he didn't even have to aim. The mindless were so thick. The sticks churned out an astonishing stream of light that ripped the forward ranks apart, and those that followed were immediately hosed down as well. The gun was a death rattle. A white-hot butcher's knife slicing knobs of undead butter. And all the while he was shooting, at the tail end of his unchecked astonishment at the level of destruction he alone was causing, he wondered how, seriously, how the hell did he not get his meat mittens on one of these things in the first place? He could hold off a goddamn army of the undead with one of these guns. He could mow down entire hordes of the screamers. He could... The gun ceased firing. That single, near-continuous laser beam stream of heavy metal demolition stopped without warning, and something clicked against Gus's cheek, startling him like a thumb jammed into his ballsack. He lowered the weapon and saw it was empty. Goddamn empty. 60, maybe even 100 rounds gone in less than 15 seconds. "The fuck?" Gus blurted, and realized right then and there where he was, what he was doing. 50 meters out, and less than half to where the blast doors shut, the mindless kept right on charging. Gus nearly ripped his fingernails off as he grabbed onto the emptied magazine, whereupon he immediately flung the casing away, only to realize he didn't have any fresh spares, just fresh guns. He dropped the first stick's battle rifle and snatched up a second one. It was already primed, so he pressed it to his shoulder and started firing, and light, praise Jesus, pure and holy light, spat forth and ripped the undead multiple new assholes north and south of the border. That destructive onslaught clotheslined the attackers, dividing them. The charge fragmented then, as those in the rear tripped or stumbled over the dead. Instead of a single solid mass, streamers of flailing, clawing undead sprinted towards him. Gus unloaded, whipping the gun back and forth, decimating any Mo getting too damn close, and ran out of ammunition in 10 seconds.
Christ almighty, Gus mentally swore, and chucked the second weapon.
How the sweet fuck was he supposed to kill zombies when... The overhead lights lit up a full stadium's worth of undead as they blasted past the raised doors of the bunker. Very much aware of how fast they were rushing him, and very much eager to pick up the last remaining sticks, Gus grabbed for the weapon. His outstretched hand, his fucking fingertips in fact, inadvertently knocked the gun a good 5 feet away from him. It clattered across concrete, well out of reach, and presented him with a choice. A crystal clear choice. He could either go for the weapon and continue his bloody spraying down of the rapidly advancing mindless, or he could turn and run for the nearest EV. In the maddening din of his nearing attackers, Gus never even considered it a question. He went for the gun. And in his own frenzied haste, he fumbled in picking up the weapon. Through the open door of the booth, Gus glimpsed figures storming past the window therein. And if the mindless were noisy before, they were deafening now. With a distressed whimper, he snatched up the firearm. Didn't get a good grip on it. But that didn't matter. He had the gun. Now all he needed was cover. He whirled and lunged for the nearby doorway of the security booth, where the frame smacked the weapon out of his hand. That sudden freeing of the gun jerked his head around in time to see the contrary piece of plastic and metal skitter along the floor. In his peripheral vision, outlines continued blurring past the window of the booth. He could hear their feet rattling off the floor, getting closer. Inside the booth, Gus spotted a keypad next to the door. He slapped his palm down on a red button right below a green one. The booth's door slid shut just as a torso appeared in the gap, just as dozens of fingers scrambled to stop the closure. The door closed anyway, momentarily muting the screams from beyond, a second before the hammering began. A furious taiko drum set where the musicians had loaded up on performance-enhancing drugs and were swinging for distance. Gus thumbed an additional knob, and a message flashed across a small screen, notifying him that the door was locked. Sighing with relief, he backed away from the rattling surface and flinched at the startling pounding on the booth's window. Dozens of mindless were there. Men, women, teenagers, all banging the glass surface with skin-splitting force, letting the living know they knew he was in there. The clear pain trembled under the assault, and Gus pushed himself up against a table shoved against the opposite wall. Office organizers spilled pens and paper clips onto the floor. He ignored the mess, his attention fixated on those savage, wide-eyed faces. Some pressed their cheeks against the glass, stretching pallid skin. Others flattened their foreheads. Others face-planted the clear surface and smashed out their remaining teeth in bursts of bloody spit. Noses squashed in red spurts. One woman reared back in superhero style and punched the glass, breaking her knuckles in a rain burst of dark matter. But she kept on punching, heedless of the ruination of her hand. Mindless. No other description really applied, or mattered. And despite their breaking bones and bursting skin, they kept on smashing at the door. The scent, he realized. The urine covering him drove them glue bag crazy. They could probably smell him right now, right down to his dewy dingleberries. The mindless crowded the security booth, filling the window from left to right. There weren't as many as before, and Gus thanked Christ for that. At least he thinned out the herd a bit before he took sanctuary within the checkpoint walls, which were a lot more resilient than he'd thought. Still, the sight of the mindless mere feet away from him, beyond a partition of unknown material and thickness, did not lift Gus's spirits. He wasn't free. He was in a long box, on display, witnessing dead people smash the living shit out of themselves. That stopped him in his tracks. Gus watched the undead outside, thinking back to his own shooting spree. Could they be killed by shooting the body as well as the head? He'd had his chance to clarify that and missed it. He couldn't see shit past the gore-stained glass. The mindless outside continued to inflict terrific injuries onto themselves, and they showed no sign of slowing down.
It's like a fucking Black Friday sale out there, Gus said under his breath.
The glass was holding, but he didn't know for how long. Once they got through, he'd be dead. The closest thing he had to a weapon was... He looked around the office area and spotted a large stapler next to a keyboard. The walls rumbled as he trudged into the back of the booth. More body armor, but no weapons in sight. There were still a few magazines underneath the gun rack, but no guns to use. The booth's windows seemed to shiver under the constant bombardment of faces and appendages. He'd be safe for a while, he figured, until... Well, shit. Until the masked sons of bitches that were chasing him arrived on scene. That tomfuckery, he thought, channeling his inner Toby, would simply not do. But there was no way out of the box. There was only one door, and that had been shut. He sized up the walls, the floor, the ceiling. The square grid of an air duct stared back at him. 39. Gus stood on a chair to remove the 6 screws securing the grate, and then he pried the thing open. Before he could climb into the duct, he had to place the chair on a table to reach.
See you later, bitches, he said before straightening up inside the duct.
He faced a solid wall, so he turned around and met the shriveled gaze of a dead man staring right at him. Gus screamed. His shoulders rattled off the edges as if electrified, and he almost lost his balance on the chair. The dead guy remained the same, which allowed Gus to warily compose himself. A shot of anger bubbled up inside of him, and he almost punched the corpse. That's when the screwdriver got his attention. Pushed to the hilt into the dead guy's brain. Through his right eye.
Well, damn, Gus whispered, examining the shriveled corpse and cringing at what had to have been a painful death.
The drumming below reminded him of his own situation, so he pulled the body out of the ventilation duct and out of the way. It was awkward, and it took a minute, and it almost distracted him from the zombies hammering at the glass. In the end, the dead guy fell to the floor, thankfully missing the chair. The corpse landed with a thud, with those dry, yolky eyes staring at the ceiling. The dead guy's mouth, caked in black, was locked in a grimace. Gus understood why. He hadn't seen it when he was pulling the dead guy out of the vent, but when the body was on the floor, it was obvious. The guy's lower left leg, the meat of his calf, had several bites taken out of it, pant leg and all. Perhaps the mindless had gotten to him as he was hoisting himself up into the ductwork. Perhaps that first crackling bite had energized him enough to get above his attacker, and perhaps... Just perhaps the dead guy, realizing he was about to be a dead guy, had decided to end it on his terms. But sticking a screwdriver into his eye, straight through the brain. That is nasty, Gus whispered in horrified awe. He pushed the chair back into position and climbed into the duct. He looked down the shaft and saw at the other end an opening glowing with soft light. Gus recreated the rest of the dead guy's backstory. He was probably being pursued from the other end, crawled up and into the duct, got bitten, and realized when he crawled over to this grate, he couldn't open the damn thing from the inside of the shaft, couldn't unscrew the grill from his side. Thanks, buddy, Gus said, knowing the other end had been left open. Sensing he had very little time remaining, he hoisted himself into the duct. The hardest part of getting in wasn't taking the screws off the grill, it wasn't pulling the grill down either. It was pulling himself up into the narrow shaft. He finally pushed off on the seat of the chair, feeling it give under his toes, and then crashed to the floor. Then he was lying in that rectangular box, his legs swinging. Dust as thick as white frosting coated the metal. With a groan, Gus realized just how tight the system was. He also realized he wouldn't be able to pull up the grate behind him since there was no way he was turning his ass around in such cramped quarters. Nor was he able to go far, as the ductwork had wire mesh placed inside the system, barring off portions to no doubt dissuade anyone from doing what he was about to do. The only grate that was free and open was the one the dead guy had accessed. Gus pulled his legs up and crawled through the passage, knocking his knees and elbows along the walls. He eventually stared down into a room that needed a little more than a bottle of sanitizer and a cloth rag to clean it up. Desks were upended, computers were trashed, paper and other office materials had been flung in every direction as if the world's dirtiest battle royale had gone off right below him and the organizers left without cleaning up their shit. And right in the middle of it all was a stepladder, lying on its side, leaving him with an 8-foot drop to freedom, of a sort. Gus sighed. With no room to maneuver, nothing to hold on to, and no cushion to stop his fall, he prepared himself for impact.
This is gonna... Fuck,
he grimaced, not liking the next few seconds in the least. He stuck his head out and glanced around. The room itself might have been an office before an undead typhoon struck it. There were a few bookshelves, but nothing else. To his right was an open door leading to a dark hallway. The faint light source turned out to be a single fluorescent bulb, tube-shaped, set into the wall above the door. Emergency lighting, or at least some sort of energy conservation measure. Nothing moved, so Gus edged forward, got one arm through, and then plopped onto his chest and got the other arm through. Then he was dangling from the shoulders, then from the sternum. The ladder would be his not-so-friendly cushion. Gus edged forward, reaching for the ladder, when gravity grabbed him. He crashed headfirst and landed on his back, hyperextended at the waist. The impact stunned him, only for a few seconds, before the discomfort settled in. Still, armored as he was, no arms or legs were broken. Gus slowly got to his feet and kicked at the ladder.
"Piece of shit," he mumbled. "Do your job next time."
He eyed the door. In the muted distance, the mindless continued to crash against the glass, wondering what he was doing. Gus examined the wall and figured a foot of concrete separated the two rooms. That was fine by him. It gave him time to find some clean clothes. The open door beckoned. Gus waded through the clutter and stopped upon the threshold. There was nothing around to use as a weapon, not even a broom. Nothing could be heard outside, and the way he was stinking, if there were mindless out there, they would have taken a run at him by now. Gus peeked around the corner, and there was light. The moment he stuck his head outside, pale emergency lighting flickered to life, illuminating the edges of the hallway. The walls were a rich red panel wood, the kind one might see in a fancy elevator, with a single brass rail on either side that gleamed under the light. A padded material of some kind covered the floor. The ceiling was something else, however. It mimicked the open night sky, its surface revealing the Milky Way in all its celestial beauty. And as Gus watched, the emergency lights continued to brighten, revealing more of the hallway and its features. Without warning, the hall to the right dimmed, but the light to the left remained on. Gus took in that starry expanse, wondering just how deep they were underground. One thing was certain, Whitecap had power. Limited, perhaps, but it had power. Not wanting to walk along in the dark, Gus went left, keeping a shoulder to the wall. His footfalls were softened by whatever material padded the floor, but he kept glancing back, checking for pursuers, either for the mindless or just regular Moes. Because they were different, he realized. One could be killed by just headshots, while the other could be killed just like a regular person. Why was a mystery. One he may never solve. As Gus made his way down the hall, he passed a wide glass door with the word "library" etched across. He stopped and peered inside and spotted numerous computer terminals, VR decks, and multimedia booths, as well as shelving for a respectable collection of books. Penlights winked on and off around the librarian's desk, but the place was otherwise empty, and the doors did not open. There were more doors along the grand hallway, unlabeled, closed, and metal. Gus passed by a fire station, complete with a hose, but missing an axe. The hallway ended, and he wandered into an exceptionally large chamber where the red paneling ended in angular cuts of bedrock. A single mighty column of wet rock, perhaps the girth of a California redwood, stood at the center of the room. Water trickled down over the rock and dribbled into a pool that ringed the rock's base. The air was moist and pleasant, like that of a small lake in the summertime. The ancient-looking pillar of corded rock reached the ceiling, which again simulated a clear night sky. Gus stopped and gawked at the stars, and realized as his eyes drifted to a rocky edge that one section was gradually getting brighter, as if heralding the approach of the moon. Constellations spiraled into focus, the stars twinkling through a soft cloud. That got him thinking, remembering. A report he once watched on television, regarding bunkers for the ultra-rich. Subterranean dwellings, particularly bunkers, might impart a touch of claustrophobia upon long-term residents, in addition to other mental illnesses he couldn't rightly remember, so creating an underground world that mirrored the one above was crucial. Convincing the mind that one wasn't living beneath the earth for months, even years, was essential for long-term mental wellness. Maintaining the illusion of day and night and its regular passing, right down to the precise second of sunset and dawn, was crucial for long-term survival. The stars above were probably some elaborate screen playing a recording, or even the actual onset of night as seen by a hidden camera posted outside and broadcasting real-time feeds. In any case, it certainly looked like Gus was standing at the base of a solitary butte, deep within a hidden slot canyon, enjoying the onset of night. Except it was entirely manufactured, constructed. A technological mirage designed by experts and convincing enough that Gus almost wanted to stop, pull up a lawn chair, and just stargaze. As he watched, the outer edge of a full moon peeked into view, beginning its arc across a cloudless night sky. As his wonder grew, he became aware of the sound of crickets chirping all around him. Four passageways led out of that fabricated canyon. Only one of these had its emergency lights on. Gus paused, listening, and other than that soft chirping of crickets, he heard nothing. Certainly no mindless. He decided to explore the lit hall. The size of the installation and its attention to detail staggered him, mesmerized him. At one point, the corridor widened into three lanes. Sky blue walls replaced the panel wood, while artificial palm trees, beach grass, and colorful flower beds adorned the path. In some places, trees rose up on both sides only to be chopped off at the ceiling, but dark imaging that resembled branches thick with leaves spread outward, creating an illusionary canopy. Soon the trees grew in number, narrowing the path to just one lane. Meadows broke out throughout the wooded area, where all sorts of flowers sprouted, while in the distance, some 10 feet back, a calm sea, or a wall-sized flat screen showing a calm sea, shone under a starry night. The distant silhouettes of giant mountains soared above the horizon, while columns of rock garnished with green tops sprouted out of the seafoam below. Lawn tables and chairs were set up along the walkway so people could sit and enjoy the imaginary view. Behind a wall of glass was a nighttime beach, facing a pool fashioned into the guise of a sea. The horizon disappeared into a lightless ink that Gus suspected would be blazing with starlight if he walked into the beach room, or sunlight come the morning. He reached the sliding doors leading to that wondrous mirage, but they were locked. Access denied. Gus's face soured at that. He really needed a bath. More mind-boggling sights came into existence the deeper he wandered into the bunker. Office parks and homes shone under the pale moonlight. Glass partitions revealed well-kept but shadowy interiors of pure escapism. There was an amusement hall with an arcade right out of the 1980s, a pool hall with billiards tables, bars, table tennis, the works, two small movie theaters, a mini golf course, shooting range, gyms, and swimming pools. This underground city rivaled anything he'd seen in Annapolis. He even spotted a go-kart racetrack perhaps a kilometer long. There was even a goddamned food court with a dozen different restaurants, and that blew Gus's mind more so than the go-karts. A government bunker had a Pizza Hut. Oh, that pissed him off. That pissed him off more than being denied a dip in the pool. When the fuck were the elected officials supposed to be working to save the world? None of the doors leading to the compound's attractions would open for him, as if sensing he wasn't worthy to enter. Gus meandered through it all, lost in a daze. The lights behind him switched off once he was a certain distance away,
while the road ahead continued to light up every 3 or 4 steps in front of him. Gus felt he was drifting through a museum of sorts, where every modern amenity of pre-outbreak civilization was on display. There were no people, however, not a soul in sight, and no living quarters either. Gus figured he was on a level geared toward fun and relaxation. All out in the middle of fucking nowhere, under a goddamn mountain. Considering the size, scope, and grandeur of the place, Gus was surprised politicians even bothered with Parliament Hill. He wanted to run for office just to get into one of those underground beaches. The thought of his people back on Tankook sobered him up. He wondered if they might be up for a little relocating. Unless he was missing something, the bunker seemed intact, perfect even. Except for that little thing about the mindless, and the bastards controlling them. Especially them. He entered another walkway. Gus certainly didn't call it a hallway, because no hallway was built to create the illusion of a beachside boardwalk at midnight with sailboats floating on an ocean as calm and flat as glass. He wanted a Mai Tai just from looking at all that Caribbean goodness. The floor lights kept coming to life, guiding him along, until he got to the waterfall. The canyon behind him had grabbed his attention, and the seaside stroll amazed him, but the sector he just entered stopped him cold in his tracks. The first thing he noticed was a waterfall pouring from 3 stories up over a glistening rock face. Tropical greenery clung to either side and flourished all around. The relative humidity in the room went from a comfortable 30% to a borderline 60. 2 pagodas created an ambience of zen within the chamber. Arched bridges crossed over narrow canals, all lit up in a serene display of misted flora. Gus stepped onto one little bridge, because it was lit up, and saw the goldfish swimming beneath him. That was the cherry of this subterranean cathedral of serenity. He shook his head and felt like swearing. A lot. But God probably expected him to curse a blue line, so he kept his mouth shut. Then he saw it. Behind the waterfall. A single archway of fragmented light, blurred by falling water. It was off the illuminated trail. But at this point nothing surprised him. Gus stepped off the bridge and onto a slab of rock. He carefully threaded his way through a thick garden that he probably wouldn't have been allowed to walk on, but there was no other way unless he plunked down in the water, and he wasn't about to piss off the goldfish swimming in the canals. The lights behind the waterfall flickered, and when he reached them, the most astonishing thing happened. The archway blazed through the water in a fluid white rush, and the rock wall within parted without a sound. A small elevator waited there, with that familiar redwood paneling and shiny brass railing. Gus hesitantly stepped inside, enduring a brief shower. The doors closed behind him, and the trail lights leading up to the doors winked out, as if the golden walkway he'd been following had never existed in the first place. 40. The elevator doors opened. 1 incandescent ceiling light bulb flickered to life, forming a pale cone of light just outside of the elevator shaft. Beyond, Gus could see several computer terminals, each with a battalion of monitors stacked 2 high and 3 wide. These workstations ringed a central command console where a naval officer's chair was perched upon a raised dais. A second source of light caught Gus's attention, a solitary glow that slowly drew him out of the elevator. There, some 20 paces away, was a secondary ring of computer terminals with accompanying monitors. The light came from a small lamp set to one side, well within that second ring of workstations. Gus stepped into the high-tech grotto, scrutinizing the deep shadows of the chamber. Processors whispered evil nothings in the background. Not a soul in sight. At least no one Gus could see. The elevator doors closed behind him.
Don't be alarmed,
a voice said, causing Gus to jump. The voice came from the second ring of computers. The little lamp flickered as if someone briefly blocked its light by passing in front of it.
I'm sorry, the voice said. I wasn't able to communicate with you. There's been damage to the system isolating me up here. Communication isn't my forte.
A giggle then, low and hoarse and strained. Gus didn't move. He was still well-armored, but weaponless.
I won't hurt you, the voice said. I think that should be clear. You wouldn't...
Another unnerving giggle.
You wouldn't be here, if not for me.
You were lighting up the hallways? Gus asked.
Ah, yes, to a point. In the main sectors, the emergency lighting is automatic, to conserve power. We still have considerable stores of it, but why waste it? These days, power is like clean water, clean air. Come closer. I won't bite.
But the words finished in a scratchy, throat-blasted giggle that rattled Gus's nerves.
Please, the voice said.
The lights emanating from the monitors switched off, but the table lamp remained on. There was a motorized whirring, and half a figure, the shadowy head and shoulders of a man, rolled into view from behind the stacked computer screens.
I'm here, the dark outline said. Come closer.
Gus wavered.
You're not going to try anything?
I will not. You,
he chortled again.
You have my word.
I don't mean much these days.
Please, remember, you're here because I wanted you to be here.
Gus supposed that was true.
Where's here?
Security, command, the watchtower, the inner keep of the king, the kingdom.
Gus took a cautious step forward, staying close to the wall. He eyed the edges of the room, watchful for others potentially hiding in the dark. All the while, the seated figure remained still. Gus's boot kicked something, freezing him in place. He looked down and saw the outline of a plastic container the size of a pack of cigarettes on the floor. It was too dark to see anything else.
Oh? The giggle again. The floor might be filthy. Keep your boots on.
The giggle spiked in a wheezy piping that damn near made Gus look for a keyboard or a chair to swing just in case.
You're awfully fucking merry over there, he said.
I'm sorry,
the figure said, and genuinely sounded like he was.
It's a nervous reaction. If you've seen the things I've seen, you'd be a little nervous too.
You're not crazy, are you?
A solemn reckoning, then.
I don't think so.
Which, in Gus's mind, gave him a 50-50 chance that the man was fucking insane.
Come closer, the figure urged.
Gus took another two steps before his foot crunched on another plastic container. Then another.
You don't house clean up here? He asked.
I'm sorry. Really, I didn't expect anyone. Really, not ever. I thought I'd be alone here for the rest of my life, so... You understand. Things just got thrown around.
Gus kicked a clutter of plastics, and what he kicked rattled off more unseen garbage. He took another step and looked down. A carpet of discarded plastics covered the floor, thick enough to crowd the ankles of his boots. The giggle again from the shadowy figure.
I'm sorry. The janitors haven't made their rounds in some time.
Guess not, Gus said. And without thinking, he bent over and picked up one of the containers. Oddly enough, they all seemed to be the same size. He brought the item in close.
Deodorant stick.
An empty deodorant stick, right down to the inner plastic.
Well, at least you don't stink, Gus said under his breath.
He casually dropped the used container.
No, I don't stink. Well, not much anyway. You get used to the smell, I suppose.
Gus moved closer to the man. He took a quick look at the computer screens, all showing video feed from surveillance cameras around Whitecap. Storefronts, living quarters, hallways. A screen switched feeds and displayed the empty beach that he'd just passed, but from the inside looking out. Sitting next to a keyboard in a bloom of ripped packaging was a case of deodorant sticks, four of them unopened. Gus looked to the mystery figure seated in front of him. The man was in a wheelchair, some 15 feet back or so, his features indiscernible in the dim light. What Gus did see, however, made him uneasy. He'd seen this before. Gus became aware of a smell, of unwashed flesh and unscrubbed crevices. "Don't worry," the man said.
"Don't worry. As I said, I won't hurt you."
The silhouette shivered then, around the jawline. The speaker's skin was dark, again just barely visible, but the eyes, the right more so than the left, were wide open and blinking. All the while, the man's chin quivered as if he'd just taken a dip in Arctic waters.
"Don't stare,"
he said, catching Gus's scrutiny, and he smiled, quelling that alarming trembling of the mouth.
"Don't. It's not polite."
He ended that with another chuckle, one that he cut off as if realizing the sound might very well be unnerving to his guest, which it was.
"Just stay right there," the seated man said. "Where you are. That's close enough for the moment."
The smile was a permanent thing, Gus soon realized, only diminished with a concentrated effort. The shivering of the lower jaw was just as continuous, as was the smell of the man's unattended ass crack.
"My name is Joshua. Rogan."
The head twitched then, but Gus forced himself to pay that no mind.
I am a research assistant working in biology with the medical corps stationed at Whitecap.
Gus nodded a greeting,